Hello, Nikki.
Hello, Mikey.
You ready to go this week or what?
I'm so excited about this. This was such a great idea of yours.
This is going to be a lot of fun. Today, we are going to be talking, and before I get started, I want to introduce the show. This is Through the Lens with Mikey and Nikki. I'm Mikey, and Nikki is a good friend that I've known for many years, and we both share a passion for movies, and today we are going to be talking about horror movies of the 70s. Which, when you think about it, you know, I don't know about you, Nikki, but I kind of feel like the horror movies of the 70s were scarier.
100% on a lot of different levels, which I know we're going to cover today, but I would say it was the peak of that genre to really set the tone for what we have going on even for today.
Yeah. You know, I think about certain movies from the 70s, horror movies from the 70s that I think, gosh darn, if that came out today, that would be shocking. And then there's some movies that you think of where you go, oh, that would be nothing today because, you know, today has gotten so crazy in terms of horror movies. But there are some from the 70s where they were pretty raw.
Yeah, and they even hold the test of time. Even some of the ones we'll discuss today, rewatching them, they still scare the crap out of me.
Yeah.
To this very day.
So why don't we go ladies first? What movie, what is one of the movies that you really loved from the 70s horror film?
Well, I'm a huge Wes Craven fan.
Uh-huh.
And his debut film was Last House on the Left, made in 1972. And it's not as well known as his others, obviously the Scream franchise or the Nightmare on Elm Street series. But this one was so gritty. And really, it's about these two girls on the way to a rock concert, and they're kidnapped by a group of convicts and subsequently raped and tortured and murdered. And it's shocking realistic violence that's up on the screen, but that's not even halfway through the film. And they are on the run and they end up at Mari, the title character, the murdered teenage girl's parents' house. And through different clues, they figure out that these are the people that have taken their daughter and they exact revenge. And then the movie goes into a whole different realm. And it is beyond. I love that Wes Craven started the film basically with warning signs. So black screen, red lettering, bold, not recommended for people over 30 because of heart conditions. Sights and sounds far beyond anything you've ever tested. Take only as much as you can. And to avoid fainting, keep repeating, it's only a movie. It's
yeah.
only a movie. I mean, he sets the film up for about what you're about to see. And it is grotesque, but you are just involved. And like I said, once it becomes to the revenge part of the film, you are just rooting for these parents.
Yeah.
Like in the most sinister way. And it's incredible. And it still holds the test of time. It's definitely a testament to Wes Craven putting his handprint on horror films and where he started and what that evolved into.
Well, I mean, I got to say, you know, of the movies that you're going to be talking about today, Last House on the Left is the one that I haven't seen. But just from your description, I'm like, holy cow. You know, I mean, it sounds like one of those movies where, yeah, maybe even today that would be a lot, you know, that would be pretty heavy.
It is. And thankfully, you know, with streaming services, you can actually stream it on YouTube right now. You can actually also get it on Amazon Prime, which I love because, you know, there are no blockbusters like you and I growing up what you were going to do. But you can get it and you can see it and really just take yourself back to that real grit. I mean, it was totally grainy as far as the cinematography went. It wasn't polished whatsoever. And there's a lot of scenes, especially the torture scenes, that have absolutely no music whatsoever.
Oh, no soundtrack.
So
wow. That's always so compelling.
Just the screams.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just the screams. And I have goosebumps right now thinking about it. I'm going to probably rewatch that tonight. It is one of those you just get sucked into. What about you, Mike? What was your first one that you were just like, '70s horror, this I'm in?
I'm going to kind of go in order because I have a passion for all three of the movies that I'm going to be talking about today. But I got to ask you this question. Before I get to my first film, I got to ask you this question. How old were you when you saw Last House on the Left?
Last House on the Left was actually a gem that I found after really getting involved with cinema, that I was more in my 20s.
Okay.
This wasn't a childhood experience for me. I had grown up with Nightmare on Elm Street and Freddy Krueger in the 80s. And just was enthralled with that series and wanted to know more about Wes Craven and started going way back to the films that he had made and discovered that more in my 20s when it was Last House on the Left.
Gotcha.
And that was, yeah. And it was, it made me understand what his filmmaking, how it started and how it evolved. Yeah. So it was pretty cool.
Because one of the things that I noticed is that, I'm older than you, and so my movies were the 70s, and I was watching them in the 70s when I was a kid, and a lot of us do, you know, a lot of us see these really scary movies by going over to a friend's house for a sleepover and their parents don't know what you're watching or that kind of thing, and so for many of us it was like when we were kids, you know. So I saw a lot of these movies when I was a kid. I'm going to go chronological. So I'm going to go in order of year. I've got three movies that I'm going to cover today. And the first one that I'm going to cover came out in 1974. And to say that this film was shocking in 1974 is a massive understatement. And it's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Now, if you've never seen the original 1974 Texas Chainsaw Massacre, there's a couple things that you need to know about it. Number one, it was one of only two really good Tobe Hooper movies. Tobe Hooper's the director of the film. He directed Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and he also directed Poltergeist. Although, when you think about Poltergeist, Steven Spielberg was the executive producer, and it looks more like a Spielberg film than it does a Tobe Hooper film, per se. But Tobe Hooper was, in 1974, absolutely groundbreaking. And this is how the film starts.
The film which you are about to see is an account of the tragedy which befell a group of five youths, in particular, Sally Hardesty and her invalid brother, Franklin. It is all the more tragic in that they were young. But had they lived very, very long lives, they could not have expected, nor would they have wished to see as much of the mad and macabre as they were to see that day. For them, an idyllic summer afternoon drive became a nightmare. The events of that day were to lead to the discovery of one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of American history, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I remember seeing that, Nikki, when I was about 12 years old, and just that opening, I was scared.
Oh yeah, are you kidding me?
By the way, that's John Larroquette doing the voiceover there. And a couple things, you know, I'm really into little trivia facts about movies and stuff like that. So when the movie came out, they premiered it in San Francisco, but they didn't tell the movie audience what they were about to see. In fact, they told them that they were going to see a movie called The Taking of Phelim 123, which was later redone starring Denzel Washington. But that's what they thought they were going to see. And the movie comes on, and people were, true story, vomiting. People were leaving the theater in tears. People felt like they had just been assaulted. And The film is absolutely brutal. But there's a couple things to remember about it. Number one, I think I mentioned this, it is studied at USC Film School for very good reason. It's really, really well done. Both of my brothers are much, you know, I've got three brothers. They're much older than I am. And my two oldest brothers actually walked out of the film. One of them actually drove out because it was at a drive-in, and it was when the movie came out. And one of them drove out of the drive-in, and the other one saw it separately, and he walked out. And the reason that they did is they couldn't take it. It's just so raw and so gritty. And I think that it is a masterpiece in the horror genre. What did you think of Texas Chainsaw, the original, Nikki?
Well, here's the deal. I discovered Texas, as we all know, I think I've said this on a couple of podcasts now, I have an obsession with serial killers. And I was reading about Ed Gein. And there had been talk about the fact that Leatherface was loosely based on Ed Gein. Right. And so I was like, all right, let's check this out. And I turned it on, and I was not ready. I wasn't ready for a family accountable.
No.
That was not something. And I didn't know what I was getting into when I watched it. And I couldn't stop.
Yeah.
I could not stop. And it was the iconic scene that still stuck me. And to this day, it's when Leatherface is outside swinging around the chainsaw.
Yes, that is definitely an iconic scene. And if you've never seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the plot of the movie is that these young kids go on a drive, you know, one Sunday afternoon, and they run out of gas, and they are trying to find a house where they can make a phone call, and they stumble upon a house of cannibals, of human cannibals. And it is it's something. I remember, Nikki, I got a story about, you know, when I was working in radio years ago, I worked with a team on the radio station named BC and Woody. And, you know, we were all adults at this point. And this was back in 1999. And we were at their house. We were drinking some beers, and we were at BC's house drinking some beers, and the topic of Texas Chainsaw came up, and I was the only one that had seen it. So I said, oh, why don't we go rent it? At the time, there was a Blockbuster. Okay. Remember Blockbuster?
Oh, are you kidding me? I still have my card.
Bet you do.
I totally do.
That's so great. That's so great. So we go to Blockbuster and we rent it and we start the movie, and they're all joking around. Okay. There was four of us there. There was another guy there, who I can't remember his name, but it doesn't matter. But we're all, except for me, I'm not joking around. The three of them are horsing around as the movie is starting, right? Well, there's a scene where it's really, I believe, the first kill in the movie. And a guy wanders into the house, and there's a big metal door. And he walks up to that door, and Leatherface, who's the killer in the film, hits him over the head with a sledgehammer, and his feet are jostling up and down as he's been hit in the head with this mallet. And when Leatherface, after he stops moving a little bit, Leatherface grabs his body and throws it out of the way like it's a gunny sack, and then he grabs onto that big metal door and slams it shut. And then the music comes on and goes boom, and all three of these guys shut up. And for the rest of the film, they were paying attention. There was no more joking around.
Yeah.
And that was the impact that Texas Chainsaw had. I mean, it's a scary ass movie.
Well, and it influenced, just like you were talking earlier about it being studied in film school, it's very obvious in other films where they took their cues. Take Devil's Rejects by Rob Zombie.
Yeah.
I can count 20 scenes just off the top of my head right now that are directly correlated from Texas.
Oh, wow.
It was a pioneer, absolutely, on how to write a horror film that engages you and does give you not the jump scares, but the in your face scares.
Yes.
Like you said, the slamming of that door, you just go,
you're right.
And it stops you.
The other thing that gets you about Texas Chainsaw is it's shot almost in documentary style.
Yeah.
And the way that they set up, the way that Toby Hooper set up the macabre was unreal. When Marilyn Burns falls into the room where the chickens are in the cages.
Oh.
And there's furniture made of human bones and there's yep. feathers all over the floor. And it's the middle yep. of summer. And when they shot it, they were all dying of heat. I mean, it was mm-hmm. it was one of the hottest summers in Texas. They shot on location. And I can vividly remember that scene of Marilyn Burns, you know, like gasping for breath when she falls into that room and the chickens are, you know, doing their thing and the feathers are all over the place. And she's like, it's unbelievable, you know?
Yeah.
And the iconic yeah. scene, you know, you mentioned the iconic scene at the end where he is flailing in the middle of the road with that chainsaw. The one that I remember and the one that got me, especially as a kid, was seeing her put on that meat hook.
Oh, God. Okay.
That was
forgot about that for a
minute. Oh my gosh, that was so that was terrifying.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's Chainsaw. What about you, Nikki? You got another one for me?
Yeah, and this one was one from my childhood, and this is one I certainly watched actually with my parents. You got to love the 70s because at that time it was like, yeah, let her watch Halloween.
Yeah.
It's not going to be too bad. It won't be too bad. There's a pumpkin with a knife on the trailer poster, but I mean, they're just carving. Right. They're just carving.
This is so when our parents were pregnant and drinking and smoking at the same time.
Oh, yeah. And we rode our bikes. There was no helmet. Right. Are you kidding right. me? Are you kidding
we were
me?
We were in the back of trucks.
Oh God, all the time. Yeah. Hold on.
Okay.
Okay. I'll grab your tab and let's go. So for me, it was Halloween, made in 1978, John Carpenter. He had, just came off of Assault on Precinct 13 and they made this film for no money whatsoever.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, the budget was literally nothing. It was literally nothing. In fact, most of the budget actually went to get Donald Pleasance, who plays Dr. Loomis in the film. It all went really to pay him just so they could get a name in the film. Because at the time, this was Jamie Lee Curtis's first film. She was only known as Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh's daughter. And she was known as a legacy because Janet Leigh was in Psycho, but she wasn't the screen queen that she turned out to be. And this was Jamie Lee's first film, and it was shot in 22 days. Like I said, for nothing. John Carpenter.
They did it in 22 days, Nikki?
Oh, yeah, they did. They did Halloween in 22 days. And what I love about this film was this was, well, let me backtrack for a second. If you haven't seen Halloween, there is this 6-year-old little boy named Michael Myers who kills his teenage sister in 1963, is sent away to a mental institution and escapes 15 years later on the way of the same Halloween night and terrorizes. And it is the beginning of the slasher genre. It was prior to Friday the 13th, prior to all the slasher films. And this was really done so well, because if you think about the entire film, number one, most of the killings are done off screen. It's not shot, so you're seeing the blood and the gore or any of those things. It's the pounding piano music as Michael Myers in his white mask with no distinct characteristics, wielding a knife the entire time. And it's not about the blood. It's not about the gore. It's about being at the wrong place at the wrong time. And John Carpenter's given a lot of interviews of his idea of the modern day boogeyman. And during that time in 78, they were ripe because this was the height of serial killer season. You had Son of Sam, you had Ted Bundy, you had John Wayne Gacy, the Hillside Strangler. And John Carpenter really wanted to capture what it felt like to not have reasoning behind these killings. He wanted you to feel like you would be stalked for no reason and you weren't safe. And that's exactly how I remember feeling as a very young girl.
Yeah.
Watching this film. Yeah. Is Michael Myers is probably out there and that kid don't die.
Right.
He just doesn't die. But again, it's unlike Texas that was gory and horrific and had those types of scenes. Michael Myers, it was about the music. It was about the buildup. It was about he's coming for you. Because it's not like he's running after you. Not like Leatherface. It's like Michael's going to just quietly pace towards you.
Right.
Every time.
Yes.
And he's coming for you. And that it was all about the suspense buildup. And that's what really made Halloween the scare film that it is even today. Because it plays well today. You can go back and watch Halloween and just be scared out of your mind.
Yeah.
And that's a true horror film right there.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that's really cool too is that the movie Halloween, the music you mentioned. Okay. So the music is great in the film. But what's great about it is John Carpenter wrote the music and performed the music himself.
Yes, he did.
And as soon as you hear that music, it's just so creepy, right? I mean, it's just so creepy. And it's so ominous.
Michael's walking towards me right now. I can feel
it. Oh, yeah.
I can literally, that's literally what pops into my brain the minute I hear that score. And it is fascinating that John Carpenter actually did all that himself.
Yeah.
At the time, he had no idea how iconic this was going to be, but that is embedded in your brain.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things that every disc jockey in the history of being a disc jockey on Halloween day always plays that music.
Oh yeah.
You know, we always play that music. I mean, there's nothing more, that is more of a iconic sound for Halloween than that sound.
No, I mean, I'd even put it up to Friday the 13th, Jason, right?
Exactly.
Right? I mean, that you've got that, but that's nothing compared to Michael Myers. As far as I'm concerned, it just doesn't even shine.
I am with you on that. And I remember seeing it, and I was really young. And the thing that was so creepy to me, you know, obviously one of the things, the biggest thing that's creepy about it is that he just doesn't die. This guy just keeps coming back. But the thing that I thought was so creepy and also so iconic was that mask.
Oh.
I mean, yeah. You don't just go into it like a spirit store at Halloween time and buy a mask like that. Like, that was a very original mask that he wore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know, just so creepy.
And you know the story behind that mask, right? You don't know the story behind that mask? Okay, so that was actually a William Shatner mask that John Carpenter turned inside out and painted white.
You're kidding me.
No. I'm telling you, this was low budget. right? He made his own score. He made his own thing. And he was like, what's creepy? And again, his mind in that idea of serial killer, basically the faceless killer, was just that. Don't have any distinction on the mask. And he just took a William Shatner face mask, turned it inside out, painted it white, and there's Michael Myers.
Wow. I'm so glad that I know that story now. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Any more on Halloween?
No, I want to hear about your next one, man.
The next one we're just going to go through kind of quickly. And the reason is because everybody knows it. Everybody's seen it. But it's one that I have to mention because I saw it at a young age. And it's Jaws. Came out in 1975. And it was, to me, and to many people, just that movie that made you never want to go back into the ocean. And, you know, it's just, it's so, so well done. And, you know, the little trivial facts about Jaws, they could never get the shark to work. You know, it was a prosthetic shark that they made. It was a mechanical shark. They could never get the damn thing to work.
Right.
They shot it in Martha's Vineyard. And, you know, it was going over budget. And mostly because of that stupid shark.
Right.
And, you know, I remember that the characters were so, they just popped off the screen. Richard Dreyfuss's character as Hooper, you know, I'll never forget Roy Schneider as Brody dropping those tanks. He drops those oxygen tanks. And, you know, Richard Dreyfuss goes, Martin, those tanks are filled with compressed air. You know, I'll never forget him. Yeah, that line, you know. And then, of course, here's another interesting fact about the movie Jaws. You're going to need a bigger boat is not in the script.
Are you kidding me?
Roy Scheider actually improvised that line. So it was never in the script. It was never meant to be said, but he said it. And when he did, Spielberg liked it and he kept it in the film. So when you watch it the next time,
awesome.
You see him say, you're going to need a bigger boat. That was him improvising.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
It was also at the time, the highest grossing film of all time when it came out. Of course, been eclipsed by gajillions of dollars by movies like Avatar and Titanic and things like that. But at the time that it came out, it was the highest grossing film of all time. And really great performances, some really great jump scares. I saw it in the movie theater when I was a kid. I was 12 years old, and it was still playing in Los Angeles. Years after it had come out, it was playing in Los Angeles. I must have been younger. God, that freaks me out. I remember my aunt took me. And the scene where Richard Dreyfuss's character, Hooper, is looking into the hull of the boat at night underwater and the head pops out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it just, that film made you not want to go in the water.
I didn't take baths for a year. What do you mean not go in the water? I didn't have a bath. I was terrified that a shark was going to come up from the drain.
Right. I mean,
I know. I know it's not logical, but I still don't take baths. So shower, but
That is so great. That is so great. So anyway,
just no way.
I didn't want to take too much time on Jaws, but I thought that it needed a nod, just because it was so well done, and it's still a movie you can watch today and enjoy, and it's one of my loves. What do you got, Nikki?
I'm gonna give you the film now that still to this day gives me nightmares, and I still go through and watch it, and that's 1973's The Exorcist. And that was done by William Friedkin. He got an Oscar nomination for it. And we were talking in the very beginning about this, about certain films in the 70s that you see a scene and you're like, oh, my God, I don't even know if they would do that today. Yeah, The Exorcist is packed with that. 110%. If you don't know the story, this is a story about a 12-year-old girl named Reagan, who's played by Linda Blair, who is possessed by some type of entity, and her mother, played by Ellen Burstyn, calls in the priest, the local priest, to try and help her daughter, who at the time is now levitating, speaking in tongues, and throwing up pea soup and the whole bit. And he enlists Max von Sydow, who is an expert at exorcisms. And that's the basis of the film. I will say this was one of those, you kind of touched on it in the beginning, where I snuck off to a slumber party and I watched it for the first time with a whole bunch of, you know, 12, 13 year old girls. We didn't sleep that night. There was no way any one of us were sleeping. And there was that scene, and it's this iconic scene, and it's shot from the back, so you don't see it full frontal, but it's a, you know, Reagan, again, 12-year-old girl, is masturbating with a crucifix, and you're like, I can't unsee that. I can't get that out of my brain now. And again, you're talking about the 70s. This pushed the envelope for everything, and it's still scary. Now, one of those background things, you know, Friedkin has been asked in several interviews. Everyone had decided he had done all these subliminal messages throughout the entire film. And there are a couple, but one that he definitely cops to is he had went and recorded the sound of a hive of bees. And throughout the entire film, you can hear distortion. And it's actually not distortion, it's those bees. And the reason he did that was because just by human nature, you have a fight or flight sense when you hear that sound. And he wanted to make sure that the audience was uneasy the entire movie.
You know, that film won.
Has that playing in the background.
That film won an Oscar for best sound.
Yes.
Yeah. And for me, Nikki, it's the scariest film of all time.
Really?
Yeah, I believe in, you know, in my opinion, you know, especially because of my faith, that movie is so, I could never watch it again. I could never watch it again.
Really?
No, it is the absolute scariest film ever made, ever, in my opinion.
Yeah.
There is no scarier film. You know, I got an interesting side note. You know, we were talking about Richard Dreyfuss earlier. I used to make a lot more money. And I used to live in this very nice neighborhood, and Richard Dreyfuss lived around the corner. And we also had a neighbor that lived across the street who grew up with William Peter Blatty's daughter.
And, oh my God.
And William Peter Blatty is the person who wrote the book, The Exorcist. And she was over at
and
his house.
And the screenplay.
I didn't know he did the screenplay.
Yeah, but he did the screenplay too.
Oh, he did the screenplay. Okay. So yeah, my friend Amy, she grew up with William Peter Blatty's daughter. And I remember the first time, you know, we were at a bonfire with her and her husband, Dom. And she was talking about, you know, how she grew up in Santa Barbara and all this stuff. And she said that she grew up with William Peter Blatty's daughter, and that they were best friends, and she was over at his house all the time, and he was very quiet, kept to himself, you know, he was pleasant, but that he kept to himself. And, you know, to me, the story of me seeing it, by the way, was I was 12 years old. By the way, I bring this story up all the time to my sister-in-law, because my sister-in-law, Joanne, who I love dearly, my brother worked for the railroad, and I would come and stay in Tucson every summer of my life when I was a kid, because my brother lived here in Tucson and he worked for the railroad. He was a railroad engineer. And so when he was gone on trips, Joanne and I would go to Zips, video store, and we would rent movies. And so we went to Zips, and she said, okay, you get to decide what we see. And I said, well, let's watch something scary. And she said, okay. So we went to the horror section, and there's The Exorcist. And I don't know what The Exorcist is. I mean, I don't even, at that age, I was 12. So I didn't know what an exorcist was, what an exorcism was. I didn't know any of that. And so we go back to the apartment, and it's, you know, she wants to wait to watch it at night. And here I am at 12 years old with my jaw dropped open for 2 hours. And when, and when the film ends, she gets up and she goes, good night. And she went into her, room, and she closed the door, and I'm on the couch. You know, that's where I slept, on the couch. And I'm like, I didn't sleep all night, Nikki, just like you. Like, I didn't sleep all night long.
Yeah.
It was that terrifying.
Oh, and okay. And you've never watched it.
No.
Since, right?
Mikey? No, 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 no.
Wow. That was a very firm no.
Yes. I can't do it. It's just, it's too terrifying. The demonic stuff gets to me.
Yeah.
You know, I believe that the demonic stuff is real. And so, you know, when I think back on it, I think, man, that stuff can happen, you know, very, you know, I believe it can happen. I do. And so it is like, it scared me so bad. And I could just never revisit it. Now I could revisit Chainsaw. I could revisit Chainsaw with no reservations, but Exorcist, I can't do. It's too scary. And me too. I still have nightmares about it.
See, and I torture myself. And when we were able to go to movie theaters, whenever they play it, because they always play it on the anniversary, I always go.
Oh,
I can't help myself.
Oh, man. It's too scary for me.
Yeah.
It's like, you know what it is, Nikki? It's like hot sauce that's too hot.
Okay. Okay.
For me.
All right. Like, you love the hot sauce, but you're like, I'm going to burn my entire mouth and I won't be able to enjoy anything.
Yeah, like, I won't be able to taste the flavor because it's too hot.
Yeah.
You know, and you're one of those people that can just eat like a ghost chili pepper or a scorpion pepper, you know, and be like, this is delicious, you know?
Yes. And let's deep dive into that. let's really go there. Yeah. I don't know what it is about horror films, especially of the 70s, but it's almost exhilarating to watch them.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. There's a high that you get. And I'm actually really excited about the next one you're about to talk about.
The next one I'm about to talk about is one of my all-time favorite films. And it came out in 1979. And it was directed by a very young director at the time by the name of Ridley Scott. And it is Alien. And Alien was something that my brother, my oldest brother, went to the movie theater to see it. And it was such a big deal when it came out that he actually got a booklet at the theater. They gave you a booklet on Alien. And I saw that booklet and I was like, wow, I really want to see this. And I thought it was one of the most well done, scary, claustrophobic movies I had ever seen. And, you know, the backstory on this is that it was written by a guy named Dan O'Bannon. And Dan O'Bannon had worked with another guy previously to doing Alien, a guy named Ron Shusett. And the two of them made turds. Complete and total turds. And then they had this idea for Alien, and it was so different the way that they first wrote it compared to what the ending script was like. You know, first of all, everybody had different names. You know, there was no Ripley, there was no Dallas. They all had different names than that. They were changed later to the names that you know now as Dallas and Ripley and Lambert and Brett and Kane and Ash the robot, the android or whatever you want to call him. The idea of it is that the film is about these sort of truck drivers in space. And they are they had worked a job where they were collecting ore from another planet and bringing it back to Earth. And they are a refining ship that does refining of ore. And they detect a distress beacon and go to investigate it. And it turns out to be alien life form. And it attaches itself to one of the crew members' faces and implants in him a alien. And the alien comes bursting out of his chest. And I'm sure you know the story, Nikki, but Ridley Scott did not tell the cast that that was going to happen. It wasn't written in the script purposefully so that he could surprise them with it. And when you see it, and when it comes bursting out of his stomach, or out of his chest or whatever, you can see that those reactions on their faces are very genuine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah. I mean, Ripley, yeah, is, oh, my God. Just, they're out of their skin.
Yeah.
They're out of their
skin. What was your thoughts on Alien?
So that was one of those, that was another sleepover adventure that we had rented and got away with when I saw it. When it rips out of his chest, I remember screaming and literally running into the other room and refusing to go back into the living room. And I was called so many names that night at that slumber party. It was like, oh, little prissy, Bob. And I love horror films. But I was like, oh, hell no. 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 And no.
Yeah.
And I eventually went back in. But I totally, for the rest of that film, played one of those peekaboos where I was in my sleeping bag and my eyes were out. But I would like half watch and then half jump in and then half watch. But like me being me, I couldn't stop myself and I just kept watching. And it is truly one of the scariest films out there. And again, another one made so well by Ridley Scott that it still holds to
its day. It really does.
Absolutely.
It really does. And I don't know. I don't remember. You remember the black guy in the movie who I love? Yaphet Kotto is his name. He plays Parker.
Yep.
And I love him in the film. He's so good. And Ridley Scott pulled him aside and he said, off screen, when we're not filming, I want you to really jab at and bother and annoy Sigourney. And he wanted to do that so that they would have that dynamic in the film, which they do.
Yeah,
they definitely do.
Yeah.
But Yaphet Kotto now says, I wish that he hadn't done that because I actually really liked Sigourney and she kind of thought I was annoying. You know what I mean? But it was just so well done and it just such a masterpiece in my mind.
Well, you also had the first time that Ridley really put a horror heroine in place. You certainly had Laurie Strode in Halloween and you certainly had the survivor instinct and all of them are fighters, but Ripley was in a league of her own. Ripley was a bad ass.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, bring it.
Right.
You are an alien life form and I'm going to do everything in my power to kick your ass. I mean, she is, and here's the thing. All you have to say is Ripley.
Yeah.
It's like Cher, Madonna, Ripley. That's all you need. That's all you need to know everything about that character. And I can't say enough. It was cool watching as a little girl, just watching this chick rip through this.
And what was, you know, part of, I think what her, you know, what made her so tough, she had that kind of deep voice, you know, and it made her a badass. And you're right. She was just a major badass through that film. And
it's a fun watch. And Ridley Scott knows how to take you on a ride. And that's what made Alien stand out a little bit differently than the other horror films in that genre, because all of it is a thrill, but he knew how to take you on an exhilarating ride at the same time.
He did. And there are so many iconic scenes from that film. You know, like the chest buster is obviously one of the biggest, you know, moments in the film. But also when they discover that Ash is a robot and that he is an android, and he freaks out and tries to murder Ripley. It's just, it's those scenes. I remember so well. And, you know, the line from Ash that I remember so well is, you know, he's dead and they've taken his head and put it on a table and they have electronically wired him so that he can speak. And he's got that milk pouring out over his mouth and over his face. Because he was always drinking milk throughout the entire film. And I guess that was to like lubricate him. It was his form of blood or whatever. And they are asking him questions about the alien. And, you know, Sigourney Weaver says to him, as Ripley, she says, "It sounds like you like this alien," or something to that effect. As she says, "It sounds like, oh, I remember." She goes, "It sounds like you admire it." And he says, "I admire its purity." And then as she's about to torch him with a flamethrower, before she does, he says, "One more thing." And she says, "What?" And he says, "You have my sympathies."
Yeah.
And then she torches him. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
So, okay. So moving on from Alien, have you got one more for me?
I got one last one. And this one we can just touch on. It's iconic. And it just, anybody who's ever felt awkward in high school, this was it. This was the film. And for me, it was Carrie, 1976, Ooh. Brian De Palma.
Oh, man.
And what was cool about that was it was Stephen King's first novel, but it was also Stephen King, who's done hundreds of film adaptions now. It was his first book brought to film. And he has praised Brian De Palma up and down, because really he took the approach in writing Carrie as an observer of like an ant farm, and the ant farm being high school. And Brian De Palma brought the story to life. He brought richness to it. You felt for Carrie. Everybody at one point in their life has been a little bit like Carrie. And if you're not familiar with the story, Carrie's this awkward, bullied teen, and she happens to have telekinetic powers, and a religiously fanatical mother played by Piper Laurie. And she just can't catch a break. I mean, the first scene of the film is her, and Brian De Palma shoots this beautifully. He has this women's gym locker room, steamy shower. She's in there, and all of a sudden she starts bleeding. It's her first period. But again, coming from the religious fanatical mother that she has no idea what's happening to her. She's terrified. And she becomes surrounded by all these girls that are throwing tampons at her, saying, "Plug it up, plug it up." And that's the first 5 seconds of the film.
What?
That's the first 5 seconds of this film. Are you kidding me? Where are we going from here? I mean, my God. So it's this awkward tale, but ultimately Carrie is tricked, unfortunately, once again, to go to prom with Tommy Ross, and her arch nemesis, played by Nancy Allen, named Chris, and her boyfriend, which is John Travolta, harken back to that original 5-second scene in the beginning of the film. And as Carrie goes up there, because she's been nominated as Homecoming Queen, and Tommy Ross, the handsome stud William Catt, who was Greatest American Hero, is the Homecoming King, and they pour pig's blood on her. And I will never forget as a kid watching the scene where Carrie is up there in that beautiful pink prom dress with the crown on her head, and it's just slick Carol blood soaking down, and all of a sudden her eyes get really, really big, and the gym doors slam. Yeah. And Brian De Palma, in classic Brian De Palma form, does all these split screens. It's Carrie on one side of the screen and people dying on the other side, and then flip back to Carrie, and so on and so forth. And it is a massacre.
Now, Nikki, are you like me? Do you feel like Sissy Spacek was born to play that role?
Yeah, and De Palma didn't want her.
You're kidding.
No, in fact, she was the last interview, and she'd had a boyfriend at the time that actually got her the interview, and De Palma was really straight up with him. He goes, look, I'm doing this as a favor to you to even see her, but I have no interest in her being Carrie. And she knew that. The boyfriend relayed the message. And so she decided to wear, she was in her early 20s at the time, she decided to wear this very homely dress she had had in high school. She took Vaseline and poured it all over her hair, wore no makeup, and came into the audition. And after leaving, De Palma went, that's
wow. Oh my gosh, that's a great story. That's so great. I never knew that. I never knew that. And it is.
And she nailed it.
Oh man.
She said after she left that interview, she got in her boyfriend's little car. They were all excited, and she turned to her boyfriend. She goes, I got the part. We're going to have to go home and wait for the phone call, but I got that part. I'm playing Carrie. And yeah. And
she's amazing.
Oh, she's so good in it. She's so good in it. When she's pleading, I'll never forget her pleading with the crazy Piper Laurie, just screaming, Mama, no, Mama. No,
I remember that.
And she's being locked in the. Yes, it's a great film. What about you? What about your thoughts?
You know, I remember seeing it as a kid too, and it scared me so bad. I didn't know what tampons were. I didn't know what a period was. I didn't know what any of this stuff was, because I had seen it so young. And you know, I just remember it being very realistic, very gritty. Just terrifying. You know, I remember it. I remember thinking even as a kid that the character of Carrie, Sissy Spacek, I remember even as a kid thinking, wow, you know, she's really scary. She's really creepy, you know?
Seriously.
And that's why I say I think but she was born to play that role.
Oh yeah, she was scary. However, there's just this vulnerability that Spacek brought to it, where you just feel for her.
Yeah,
you feel for her. She literally at the end implodes. The telekinetic powers just overtake everything, and it's so much, it takes the house down with her. That's what happens at the end.
Yeah,
and it's like, okay. This was a powerful film, and it's something that sits with you, and it still plays to this day. It does.
It really does. So that's going to wrap it up for this week's podcast. But, you know, we, as always, encourage you to watch the films that we talk about. And, you know, and we hope that you share your experiences in your brain as you're listening to us, and that you're remembering it too, and that you had a fun time with it. We end the segment usually by asking, what are you watching, Nikki? So is there a TV show or anything that you're watching currently, Nikki, that you would want people to check out?
Yes. And I'm going to go along in the same line as Serial Killers.
Okay. Okay.
There is a 6-part documentary on HBO right now called I'll Be Gone in the Dark. And you can stream it on Hulu or HBO Max or YouTube for that matter. But this is a documentary about Michelle McNamara, who is a Los Angeles crime writer. And she was so obsessed with putting together the puzzle pieces of actually the Golden State Killer during the 70s and 80s. She was so involved and was diving into internet chat rooms. And she actually pieced together a lot for the police investigation. And this is her journey. This is not so much about the Golden State Killer as much as it is about Michelle McNamara's obsession and seeing the signs that there was a serial killer going on, would happen to be the Golden State Killer. And Patton Oswalt, the comedian, was married to Michelle McNamara. She unfortunately passed 2 years prior to a book being posthumously put out there about this. And interestingly enough, the day that the docuseries went live on HBO, the Golden State Killer confessed.
Oh, wow.
It's so they had to go back to the documentary and revise and update because everything had happened after the filming of the documentary. And I'm not going to say anything more about it. It's a hell of a journey. I'm in the middle of it right now. This is a woman that was obsessed to see justice for the victims. And I'm in the rabbit hole, man.
Well,
it is good.
You said that it's available on Hulu.
Yeah, on Hulu, HBO Max. And
now, if
YouTube.
I do have Hulu, but do I have to have like a subscription to like HBO? Okay,
you
I
do.
Gotcha. I guess
you do on Hulu. You do. But I'm telling you, it's probably one of the best crime documentaries I've seen in a very long time. I would say it harkens me back to when I was watching about the West Memphis.
Oh, wow.
And okay, and that's just another podcast. But anyways, yes, I'll Be Gone in the Dark is what it's called. It's Michelle McNamara's journey, and it's a hell of a ride.
There you go. That's going to wrap up another edition of Through the Lens with Mikey and Nikki. I hope you enjoyed it. And Nikki, great job as always. And we will see you again next week.
Thank you, Mikey.
We'll see you.